Living Yoga Center offers yoga classes, educational opportunities, and services that promote a healthy, balanced, and spiritual lifestyle. The Sanctuary, located at 212 South 1st Street in Midtown Champaign, is a place for people of all skill levels to learn and experience yoga and other practices that nourish the body, mind, and spirit. The Living Yoga Center supports local charitable causes and nonprofits like community radio station WEFT 90.1 FM. More information is available on Facebook and their website, livingyogacenter.net.
Thank you very much. WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. And let's see. Okay. Spacebar does not engage this. Thanks for listening and supporting WEFT.
Welcome to CU Progressive News, bringing you the many voices of the Champaign-Urbana community. This program is produced in the studios of WEFT in beautiful downtown Champaign, Illinois. We are indebted to the members of WEFT who have for 35 years provided the infrastructure for independent media in Champaign-Urbana. CU Progressive News, the podcast, is sponsored by Phoenix Botanical. Phoenix Botanical was established by healthcare and business professionals to provide exceptional service and quality medicine to those that can benefit from medical cannabis. Located on Neal Street in Champaign, visit phoenixbotanical.net for more information.
Welcome to CU Progressive News. This is Sandra Auten. On today's show, we have an interview I did with State Representative Carol Ammons, a story about wages for workers who assist people with disabilities, a May Day essay by Kadeem Fuller of Black Lives Matter, and we finish with a 30-minute excerpted from a talk given on May 28th with Robert McChesney at Channing Murray. It was titled, "This is What Happens When Journalism Dies, Trump, Fake News, and Neo-Fascism." McChesney is well known to many in CU as a professor in the Department of Communications at the U of I, and from 2002 to 2012, he hosted Media Matters, which aired on WILL. He is founder of FreePress.net, a national media reform organization. So the excerpts from the talk with him will be finalizing the show today. But first, a few announcements. CU Progressive News will be changing venues and formats starting in June. We will no longer be producing an hour-long show once per week, but rather we'll be producing the shorter pieces similar to the pieces in this show and putting them out there for all the world to hear as we produce them as a podcast and also as listenable audio from Facebook and other social media. The pieces will likely be played on the morning menu shows on WEFT as well as on Brian's show called My WEFT Show, which airs on Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. That will be changing in June. And now for a couple of calendar announcements, I wanted to let you know that the 7th Art Stand is a nationwide series of films presented by movie theaters and community centers across the U.S. as an act of cinematic solidarity against Islamophobia. The Art Theater Co-op is participating and offering three specially curated film screenings in Tuesdays in May. On May 9th, starting at 7, they will be showing Sonita, a two-time Sundance Film Festival Award winner, and post-show discussion will be led by Nulafar Shembayate, Cynthia Buckley, and Ghassan Massawi. I think I got that right. And for more information on the description of that film, you could, of course, go to the Art Theater's webpage or to go weft.org/PSA. Also, St. Patrick's Catholic Church is hosting a New Americans Initiative. Actually, Citizens Workshop in Champaign County is hosting that at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Attention eligible permanent residents of Illinois. The University YMCA and the Immigration Project would like to share with you an upcoming opportunity to get help in becoming a U.S. citizen under the New Americans Initiative. And that is a not-for-profit partnership with the state of Illinois and the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, which helps permanent residents in Illinois through the process of becoming U.S. citizens. More about that at weft.org. It takes place, or go to the /PSA to the public service announcement calendar. That's taking place on Saturday, May 13th from 9 to 1 p.m. I also wanted to remind you that May is National Bike Month, and the Champaign-Urbana community is celebrating its 8th annual Bike Month in 2017. There are many sponsored events throughout May, so go to cubikemonth.org, and you can see all the upcoming events, including National Bike Month celebration on May 10th out at Meadowbrook Park. And then following that night, there's going to be a full moonlight night ride to Sydney Dairy Barn and back. May 10th is back to school day. May 14th, there's a Mother's Day weekend ride on behalf of Girls in Kenya, Mother's Day picnic on the way. There's a ride of silence on May 17th. May 20th, CU Food Cruise. Enjoy a guided tour on bike to the finest barbecue restaurants, microbreweries, and ice cream stands around Champaign-Urbana. Carl Playing at Safe Bike Rodeo on May 20th. Help kids practice basic biking safety skills. There's going to be a Spring Fling Bike Rodeo on May 22nd and a traffic skills course to help adult cyclists ride safely and legally in traffic. So again, all the Bike Month events at cubikemonth.org. And now on with the show. On Saturday, April 29th, this reporter called into WEFT, the show Higher Ground, and spoke to the host of that show, State Representative Carol Ammons and Aaron Ammons, about Carol's work as Illinois State Representative in the 103rd District, as well as her thoughts about running for U.S. State Representative in the seat now held by Rodney Davis. Here's a recording of that conversation.
Caller, you're on the air. I hope you're on the air, but you should be on the air. Are you
on
the air?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Good. That's Sandra Otten here. Hi, how are you? I can't hear you.
Somebody turned my microphone off by mistake.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I can hear you now, too. Okay. So, Carol, I am really curious. I have heard that you're not getting paid by the state of Illinois.
Yes, we just started getting paid last month after 9 months.
Are they catching you up on payments?
They are. The court ruling said that they were illegally holding our pay and needed to follow the Constitution and pay legislators appropriately.
And so you got a lump sum payout finally.
We got a lump sum payout last month, and we were so thrilled.
I bet. So your pay, does it include that you have to run your office out of it? So is that how that works?
No. Your payroll is your payroll. We're listed just like state employees.
Okay.
And they were holding our pay against the constitutional appropriation. Our office is run separately, and it is paid for in Springfield.
So how much do you get to run a political office? What is that? How does that look?
You mean the in-district office?
Yeah.
So the in-district office stipend, I think, is about $69,000, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that is for your staff, your actual in-district staff, which mm-hmm. is payroll, basically. And the majority that you have left is for your mailers and your supplies. That, mm-hmm. that kind of covers, and rent, but that covers that.
Well, I was just curious about that.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see how it works. To have access to you, such great access to a representative. So many people here, I guess, we kind of, you know, take it for granted because you have been so accessible, you know, doing all the legwork. So now you're thinking, have you, I just tuned in about 10 after, so I don't know if I missed you talking about the possibility of your exploratory race.
I hadn't had the question yet, so I didn't talk about it, Sandra. I was talking about Champaign County healthcare consumers.
Yes, which is a great thing to talk about, too, of
that's
course.
Right, that's right. But I am working, really, we are working right now on the idea. And so the idea of an exploratory committee really just includes, of course, visiting the full district, which is part of exploratory, to see what it is that the people outside of our base home want. So we're
and
doing
let's
that.
Explain what the district is. I know it goes down like to Edwardsville, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Would it include Springfield and Decatur?
It does. It's the major cities are Champaign-Urbana, Springfield, Decatur, Bloomington, a portion of Bloomington, just the western portion of Bloomington closer to us. And then down to Edwardsville and mm-hmm. Taylorville is on the other side of Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and this is the seat that Tim Johnson had for many years. Is that right?
That's right.
Uh-huh. And now Rodney Davis has it.
That's right.
Was there anybody in between Tim and Rodney?
No, no.
So it's been Republican for a long time.
It has.
Mm-hmm.
It has.
Right. And Gil has ran a couple of times trying to get it and came so close last time.
He came close last time. And I think this...
No, not the last time. Gil came close. It was several races ago when he...
within a thousand, you mean?
I think when the seat was open.
I think it was the last one. I wonder.
No, the closest he came was 1,000 votes.
That was 2012, uh-huh. I think it is.
Yeah. And I believe that's when the seat was open, though. And there was a third party that was in it that got 12% of the vote. And Gil lost by 1,000 votes.
That's
right. That was
right,
the closest that he's ever come.
Right.
But I
which
think he's
just
run
does
three
speak
times
to a couple of things. One, that it could go Democratic with the right, you know, with the right. I don't know what's right. I don't know how it'll be.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to hear you explore it and see what the issues are that you're able to bring forward. Do you have a plan? Why are you wanting to move from being the Illinois rep? Because that, you're doing such a great job and you're new, so...
Well, I mean, I think the real opportunity for us to capture the 13th and for us to have a Democratic on the 103rd would be fantastic for Illinois because we need both of those things to happen.
Yeah.
So that we would have the House here and hopefully recapture the House in the U.S. Representative House. Which, if we have a window of opportunity to do that, that might be it. Now, I'm not suggesting to you or anyone else that this is the window, right? Is the window 18 or is the window 2022, which is what the measurement needs to be about. So we're kind of trying to figure that part out of it. And
I'm not following you. What measurement? So you're trying to figure out whether or not it's really winnable in 20.
Correct. Is it winnable in 18? That's the question.
Yeah.
So we're trying to figure that out by visiting and talking. Do we have enough people in the district who are willing to get on the ground to do the grassroots work to turn it Democratic? Because the numbers suggest that we could. Do we have enough money to compete with the GOP and the big banks, right? The big people who are going to bankroll our current representative. Do we have enough money that we can bring in to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Can we register enough voters and get them to the polls?
Yeah.
Right? All of that has to go into planning a real strong campaign. And right now we're trying to figure out if we can put all those pieces together. Can we put that puzzle together to make that work?
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a big question.
It is a big question. And so we will answer the question before we take step two.
Right.
That's why we do an exploratory first, because we got to answer the questions.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. And did you feel like you did an exploratory before the last time that when you ran for the Illinois House?
We did. We actually did. We followed this same process. We started with family, which we started here with family.
Mm-hmm.
And then we brought in people, as you know, that are important to us in this area. And we had meetings with all of us.
Mm-hmm.
We laid out a plan. We looked all the way down to the precinct level to see if we could capture it. Can we do the voter registration? So we did the exact same thing to lay out the framework for the 103rd.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yep.
Yeah, well, being a business owner myself and running a business, it's just exactly like that. You just face one decision after another, get all the information you can, make the best decision you can, and keep moving, right?
That's it. And if you can't answer all of those questions, then you make a different decision, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we want to do in this case. And I do want you to know, and others who are listening, that not only do I enjoy, I am very, very happy to represent the 103rd, and we are not only planning to continue to do great work in the 103rd, but we've passed some significant legislation in this session, as we did in our first session. And so it has just been a tremendous honor for me to work on behalf of the people, and I believe in my heart that the people also reciprocate that to me as well as their representative. So,
yeah, well, you're doing good work. Can I ask you about a House bill that is about the elimination of solitary confinement?
You can. I don't know if I know all the answers to it yet, but I can certainly get them for you.
Well, I'm following it myself, but I just wonder, I'm just garnering your support here. You are in support of the bill?
And let me just look and see what it is. What's the number?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Sorry,
yeah,
I don't.
That's okay. You can call me back if you know the number, because sometimes we may have, say we have two or three bills that may look like they do the same thing. Bill A may deal with solitary confinement, removing it, and it would be something that I would support. But Bill B may be supported by another who also references solitary confinement, but may increase something within that bill for something else that I would not support. So the bill number is really important for me to be able to check and see where I am on a particular issue.
Yes, I should have had that before I asked you about it, for sure. I do know that they're trained to limit it so nobody can be in solitary for more than 10 days at a time, and that everybody has to be, even if they're in solitary, they have to be out of their cell 2 hours a day. So.
Well, if it's the Shriver Center's bill, then the answer would be yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the work you do, Carol, and we'll be following along, and I will be
The DSC, the Developmental Service Center, supports people to live a rich and meaningful life. It was formed in 1972 by the merger of four community organizations serving people with disabilities. The result is a comprehensive organization that is able to provide multiple services in Champaign, Ford, and Piatt counties. DSC serves individuals who may have epilepsy, cerebral palsy, autism, Down syndrome, developmental and intellectual disabilities, or other disabling conditions. It is through the programs and services offered at DSC that these individuals are able to pursue a more fulfilling life. While thousands of people with disabilities remain on a state waiting list for placement in small community-based group homes, one such home in Mahomet has sat empty for 19 months. DSC purchased and renovated a house nearly 2 years ago, but can't hire enough staff to open the home. This is part of a statewide staffing crisis at organizations that serve people with disabilities, not only in Champaign, but across Illinois. On May 10th, caregivers and advocates would travel to Springfield to meet with legislators and deliver thousands of signed postcards to the governor's office in support of SB 955 and House Bill 2960, bills that would increase the caregiver wage to $15 an hour and likely end the crisis. According to Dale Morrissey, CEO of DSC, the DSC needs 8 to 10 more staff to open the home in Mahomet. He says because of the wage rates, they can't find staff. They've advertised, they've done open interviews, created TV commercials, radio ads, attended and hosted job fairs. It's still a great house and perfect setting for my daughter, says David Happ, who is from Philo. He's so excited that his daughter Brittany, who has autism, is on that waiting list. But now 2 years later, they're still waiting, and it's hard to believe, he says, that the house is sitting empty. Across Illinois, agencies that care for people with disabilities are facing an escalating crisis because wages paid to caregivers, known as direct support professionals, stalled 9 years ago at $9 an hour, one of the lowest rates paid by any state in the nation and one that puts many caregivers below the federal poverty line. The Federal Court Monitor issued a report in January saying how low wages and resulting staffing crisis means that Illinois is now violating a federal decree issued in 2011 after civil rights attorneys sued the state for failing to comply with the 1999 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. All the while, caregivers are leaving their jobs at alarming rates to take positions in retail, fast food, warehouse. Jessica Vandiver and her husband both worked as caregivers, but with four children to support, they simply couldn't make ends meet. They both left their positions last year. Jessica misses her work as a caregiver terribly. She says, "I never thought I would leave, but what finally drove me back to look elsewhere for employment was constantly being understaffed. The job in itself is already full of so many variables and unpredictability, but to have the added element of never knowing if there would be enough staff to cover everything just took the stress of the job to a whole new level that I couldn't handle anymore. I've never cried as much as I cried on my last day there, and it's been months since I left, and I think about the people I served every single day." Jessica's story is representative of hundreds around the state leaving the career they find deeply rewarding, but which leaves them unable to pay their bills. The situation has left some agencies with nearly half of their caregiver staff, caregiver positions empty, and forced them to rely on temporary workers. Some agencies says the crisis is endangering the safety of the people with disabilities. Medicaid matches state wage rates, but states must raise the wages first to secure a higher federal contribution. Some agencies say the crisis is endangering the safety of people with disabilities. Medicaid, the federal program, matches state wage rates, but so the states must raise the wages first in order to secure higher federal contributions. So remember that you can get involved by participating in the May 10th group that travels to Springfield, or you can sign a witness slip online for a state Senate Bill 955 or House Bill 2960, or you could call your representatives and ask them to support those bills that will raise the caregiver wage to $15 an hour. For CU Progressive News, I'm Sandra Auten. Now we have a May Day speech by Kadeem Fuller, an organizer with Black Lives Matter.
I am a revolutionary. I am a proletariat. I am the people. I am not the pig. I beamed the big homie Fred Hampton into this space because his words still rang true today as they did when he first said them in 1969 before his untimely death. Excuse me. Before the capitalist power structure assassinated him before our very eyes and ruled it just. It is fitting that we honor the strongest among us that fought diligently against an inherent, unjust, and cruel system. However, how many laborers have died slower deaths through a system that denies us a decent existence? How many people have died without food, without homes, without insurance, without the basic needs of human beings? These things are seen as optional to our bosses, the captors of our labor, the roadblock to human development. Shout out to all the incarcerated workers, immigrant workers, sex workers, drug dealers, whose labor are consistently criminalized and devalued in this capitalist society. By honoring the most vulnerable among the working class, we strengthen the collective. We can't talk freedom from capitalist chains without including folk that have been ruled out as undesirables by the elites as well as many among us. Sex work is work. By creating a division between the value of labor of others, we are reproducing the same system that harms, kills, and destroys us all. We cannot disrupt capital without disrupting our capitalist thinking. To all laborers that feel alienated in the society that has taken all things good and replaced them with nothing but subservient and meager living, you are family. You are the working class. You are one of us. I bring into this space the millions of black and brown men and women that have been removed from this nation's means of production and have resisted through the creation of underground economies that have sustained communities that have been left for destruction under the social order of benign neglect. As we celebrate the martyrs of Haymarket Uprising on May 4th, 1886, let us remind ourselves about the sacrifices of not just the men and women that cast their lives aside to further the labor movement. Let us also take time to call to the millions of unnamed workers among our collective history, present, and future that continue to struggle against the exploitation on the local, national, and international stages. Let us not forget the black and brown folk, the femmes, queer and trans folk, the bulk of the working class that resists every day to work and live in a society that thrives off the socially constructed difference made to enforce worker subjection. Let us not forget where we are on a global stage. Let us not forget who sits on the throne of this imperialist and murderous empire. Let us not forget who the oppressor and oppressed really are in this game of accumulation versus humanity, people over profit, and bottom line over lives. This revolution cannot be fought without an understanding of how gender and race exist in this continuous class struggle. Let us not forget the white working class voted for Trump. We cannot celebrate May Day without examining this fact. We have seen just how ugly it gets when race and gender is ignored for a strict class analysis. White workers, understand how you perpetuate the system by relying upon the signifiers of race and gender to support your own labor and social positions in this society. Whiteness has always worked in this manner. The genocide of indigenous people and the displacement of Africans within the context of settler colonialism of the U.S. has removed most indigenous people from the labor market, while the labor of black folks, once proclaimed as property, has since the end of slavery been devalued and exploited in order to sustain the society we can somehow call the land of the free and home of the brave. As I close, I draw attention to the precursor of this celebration, the Haymarket Uprising. Yesterday, I went to the home of one of the dopest anarchist families I have ever met, the Khans, and I broke bread with them as well as other radical and amazing people. I was speaking to Tariq Khan, a historian of labor movement and anarchism, and he was putting me on game on the real history of Haymarket. As we all know, a bomb was thrown at police during the historic day of May 4th, 1886, killing one and wounding six others. No one knows who threw the bomb, but the state, of course, used this as a way to assassinate prominent radical labor organizers of the time. I was told by Tariq that when interviewed about Haymarket, famed anarchist Lucy Parsons said, "We should have all thrown bombs that day." I think about this statement during this political time. This time is showing us more and more each day the social and economic despair that is American as baseball for racialized and gendered workers among us. Are we all willing to throw the next bomb to sustain this struggle? Are we willing to bomb the capitalist power structure? As the American empire prepares itself for the next phases of its illegitimate order on the world, we must honor the named and unnamed heroes of Haymarket that fought for workers in an 8-hour workday. We must honor the black radical tradition that has fought for the liberation of black people. We must also honor Stonewall Riot that fought for queer liberation. These struggles all fight capital and the way it always dehumanizes the most marginalized amongst us in order to sustain itself. It's May Day 2017. Honor this day, but more so, honor the people, all of the people that make this day possible. Workers united will never be divided. Thank you.
That was Kadeem Fuller, an organizer with Black Lives Matter.
Listening to the weekly pre-recorded program, CU Progressive News. CU Progressive News is a collaborative effort. We are asking you to be a part of our collaboration. We need assistance for news readers, news gatherers, writers, researchers, fact checkers, calendar coordinator, and production assistants. Training will be provided, no experience is necessary. We also welcome stories. Whether you have an hour a week or an hour a month, we welcome your participation. Email weft90.1@gmail.com to give us feedback, story ideas, or to find out how you can be a part of CU Progressive News.
On May 28th, Robert McChesney gave a talk at Channing Murray titled, "This is what happens when journalism dies, Trump, fake news, and neo-fascism." Tonight, we're going to hear about 30 minutes of excerpts from that talk. McChesney is well known to many in CU as a professor in the Department of Communications at the U of I. From 2002 to 2012, he hosted Media Matters, a show which aired on WILL. He is the founder of FreePress.net, a national media reform organization. The talk was pretty depressing in general, the gist of it being that in order to have a free democracy where people can govern themselves, we need to have an open and free press, and we don't. He did bring some levity to his talk in his elegant description of Trump.
Trump and Clinton were the two most unpopular politicians in America. It's the choice. It wasn't like it was a groundswell of support for him. And I don't want to talk too much about Trump. It's easy to get caught up in what an asshole the guy is, to be blunt. He's an opportunist, he's lazy, he's a narcissist. He's not especially curious or intelligent. He lies endlessly, he has no sense of shame. He's singularly corrupt and out to personal gain. I mean, he's right out of the Mobutu playbook. It's extraordinary how unqualified he is. So that's all I'm going to say about Trump.
But his talk, which I will get to in a moment, was not so much about Trump. In his article, "Farewell to Journalism, Time for Rethinking," he states this: "Journalism is in freefall collapse in the United States and to varying degrees elsewhere. Unless there's a dramatic rethinking in the U.S. and to a lesser extent elsewhere, all signs point to a continued deterioration of journalism. By all known political theory, this means the continuation of credible democratic governance will be impossible. Hence, this is the crisis of the greatest possible magnitude." There's considerable consensus in democratic theory and among journalism scholars about what healthy journalism should entail. One, it must provide a rigorous account of people who are in power and people who wish to be in power in the government, corporate, and nonprofit sectors. It must regard the information needs of all people as legitimate. If anything, it should favor those without property, as those with wealth invariably have the means to get the information they need to run society. Three, it must have a plausible method to separate truth from lies. And in his talk, which we'll hear in a few minutes, he talks a lot about, we're gonna hear a lot about fake news. It must have a plausible method to separate truth from lies, or at least to prevent liars from being unaccountable and leading nations into catastrophe, particularly wars, economic crisis, and communal discord. And fourth, it must provide a wide range of informed options on the most important issues of our times. He goes on to say that it is not necessarily the case that every media outlet can or should provide all these services to their communities. That would be impractical. It is necessary, however, that the media system as a whole make such journalism a realistic expectation for the citizenry. There should be a basic understanding of the commons, the social world, that all people share, so that all people can effectively participate in the political and electoral process of self-governance. The measure of free press is how well a system meets these criteria in giving citizens the information they need to keep their freedom. There is more. Great journalism, as Bagdekian puts it, requires great institutions, Like any complex undertaking, a division of labor is required to achieve success. Copy editors, fact checkers, and proofreaders are needed, in addition to reporters and assigning editors. Great journalism also requires institutional muscle to stand up to governments and corporate power. It requires competition, so if one newsroom misses a story, it will be exposed by someone else. Monopoly is the enemy of journalism, whether commercial, non-commercial, or both. A democratic press requires people covering stories they would not cover if they were doing journalism on a voluntary basis. In short, to have a democratic journalism requires material resources that have to come from somewhere and need to be organized on an institutional basis. So that was from his article called Farewell to Journalism. And in this excerpts that you'll be hearing, you'll hear at the end his proposal for how that journalism will be funded, because he says that the method it's been funded in the past with advertising is dead, never to return. So he doesn't believe with what has happened with the newspapers and with regard to advertising that journalism will ever be funded through advertising again. So at the end of this, you'll hear his proposal for how he proposes to fund journalism.
Whether it influenced the actual outcome of the election is another matter altogether. But in general, the discussion of fake news, I think, has been completely out of context and misunderstood. I'd like to take a minute or two, put it in context, and hopefully make more sense of it, so lead the way out of fake news to actual news. For one thing, fake news is not new. It didn't begin in 2016. Fake news is as old as news. In fact, the partisan type of journalism that existed in the United States until the 20th century was rife with what we would call fake news. Every political candidate or politician, news media that attacked them, in their view, was routinely making up fake news to criticize them. That was just how partisan journalism worked. They had their press that worked for them, was favorable to them, and their enemies would sometimes stoop to what we would call fake news, if necessary, to take down the politicians they didn't like. There's probably no president that had more sincere commitment to freedom of the press and building up an independent free press than Thomas Jefferson. He had a lot of flaws. But that was one area where he has a very commendable record. And he stood out in principle in the belief of having a free and independent press system. And Thomas Jefferson held the press of his day in sheer, utter, total contempt. But at the same time, he knew and understood how important it was to have a free press system. And when he was president, he so despised the newspapers of his day that he famously wrote that a person who never read a single newspaper would be much better informed than a person who read every major newspaper every day. There was no comparison. Avoiding newspapers is the path to enlightenment if you wanted to understand the world. That was Thomas Jefferson. He dismissed it as all lies, all fake news. And throughout the partisan era, that was always an issue. In the 20th century, things changed a bit, and the change took place the rise of professional journalism. But you know, fake news is crucial to the rise of professional journalism. For example, the classic story comes with Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann was the editor of the New Republic, a famous liberal who very much supported the US entrance into World War I. Now, as you may recall, in 1916, Woodrow Wilson was reelected president in a landslide, and his campaign slogan was, "He kept us out of war. He kept us out of the European war." And that was a winning message for the American people. But Woodrow Wilson desperately wanted to get us into that war. But the problem he had was that the American people weren't interested in a war. So for the first time, the United States government decided to create fake news, aggressive, a campaign to do it, decided it was going to drum up news to create great antipathy towards Germany among American people. And Walter Lippmann went to work for the Wilson administration to try to get people to hate Germans and be keen to enter the war in Europe on the side of France and Britain. And it worked. And it was a campaign that turned public opinion fairly quickly against Germany and got the U.S. in the war. And when the war ended, Lippmann had a moment of reflection. He was disturbed greatly at the degree to which the propaganda he helped spread was swallowed hook, line, and sinker by the news media. Basically, they could get newspapers to print anything they wanted about Germany, and there was no effort to make sure it was true. Their job was just to get us into that war and get people to hate Germany. Truth had nothing to do with it. It was pure propaganda. It was fake news. And that's what Lippmann saw. And he was deeply troubled by this. So he was realized, boy, if the news could be doctored seriously, then the entire notion of a press system being a cornerstone of a democracy or a free society is blown to smithereens. And because of that, Lippmann became a major proponent of establishing professional standards for journalism, of removing control of the news from the owners, taking the partisanship out of it, and getting rid of the role of spin, propaganda, public relations in shaping the news, both business and government. Whether he held to that position later, in 1919 he was a strong proponent of it. So professional journalism emerges, and what's striking there is the way it emerged in the United States was it came to rely on public relations as the basis of news for much of its news. That means government or businesses surreptitiously planting stories that would look like real news stories served their interests. And public relations, even at the height of professional journalism, accounted for roughly 40% of news stories in the United States. And by the height of professional journalism, I mean the early 1970s, when there was the most autonomy for the journalism, when the journalist had the most resources to do work without interference. Even then, roughly 40% of news stories came pretty much directly out of surreptitious public relations campaigns. But there wasn't a PR interest, a government official pushing the story. The story wouldn't have shown up ever in a news medium. 40%. Well, today that figure is closer to 80%, 85%, or 90%. Almost all the news we see is overwhelmingly it's either fake news, something directly to what someone in power is saying, or political news, to comment on it. There's very little actual journalism generated by journalists saying, this is what I think people ought to know. I'm going to go find out what it is and report on it. That has been shelved. That really doesn't exist anymore. It's the world we're living in. And the reason for that is that we're in the midst of an existential crisis of journalism. The commercial journalism system that we've had in this country for the last 100 years or so is dying. The number of working journalists we have per capita is a small fraction of what it was just 25 years ago. Newsroom after newsroom was either closed down or hollowed out. State capitals that used to have 1 or 2 dozen full-time reporters now are lucky to have 3 or 4, some that maybe one half-time person. All sorts of news journalism is slipping through the cracks. All sorts of political journalism is no longer being reported. You see it in the daily newspapers around the country. It's happening everywhere. The reason for this is very simple. The model of commercial journalism that was established around 100, 125 years ago, that made journalism very lucrative for a century, made it one of the most profitable industries in the country, has collapsed. And that model was advertising, providing between 50 and 100% of the revenues that paid for journalism. Advertising firms had to subsidize journalism to reach their target audience, be it in newspapers, retailers wanted to reach local consumers, or nationally for national branded products, radio, television, and magazines. And advertisers ponied up. They paid what we call journalism. They gave the illusion that journalism per se was a very lucrative undertaking. But now that the internet's come along, that's gone. Almost all the advertising's fleeing supporting content. They no longer have to do it. Advertisers have better buys, better, smarter marketing decisions and options by going to the internet and going directly to their consumers. They no longer have to subsidize journalism. In fact, I just saw a report that came out recently in the last week. All the increase in advertising in the last year, all of it has gone to Facebook and Google. All of it has gone to the internet. And so there's not money there to pay to subsidize journalism. It's not coming back. And people say, oh, that's great. We'll get rid of all that crappy old media. That they were doing a lousy job anyway. Good riddance. But the problem is that the same advertising isn't supporting new media either. It's not supporting any journalism. It's not like online journalists are getting all sorts of money. They have resources to do work. Online journalists are almost worse shape. They don't even get legacy advertising. They're desperate. I've spent the last 10 years advising them, helping them try to raise funds. No one's got a model to make it work. It isn't working. It's dying. It's dead. Not happening, period. And that's the world we live in, a journalism-free environment. Now, it looks like there's journalism. You go to Google, Google and Donald Trump, and it sees 800,000 pages of stories about Donald Trump. You say, boy, there's lots of journalism here. But that's not journalism. There's lots of stuff that's no longer covered. Most of the relationship between business and individuals, governance, state, local, national level, not covered. Just not covered. Not there. And it's not going to come back. It's not going to happen. And in this environment, what journalism has done, political journalism has done, rather than actually do hard research, investigative work to clarify how power works in our society, is those journalists that left basically just repeat people in power say, and that wouldn't be very good journalism. Who's going to want to watch pure stenography? So Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch had a brilliant idea. If you're not going to have any reporters, what you'll do is you'll package your journalism, put a spin on it that'll appeal to a target audience, and that's your market, that's your model. And Fox News began that model, and now that's the rational model for anyone doing commercial news media, to say we've got a take up, and we're not going to do much journalism, but we're going to give you what you want to hear. And in this environment, it's pretty easy to dismiss all news as fake. Fake news is pretty much all news in a lot of ways. It's, you know, there's not a lot of journalism that's truly credible. And truly credible political journalism, in my view, is journalism where everyone's treated by the same standard. So we know, for example, Fox News is going to treat Trump and Obama differently, even for the exact same behavior. Just like MSNBC treated Obama very differently for when he was bombing some Eastern country than they did George W. Obama got a pass on that. George W. Bush got raped over the Christmas. And when you have news like that, almost as fake news, and then it's easy to say the critics of your news, because in some respects, they sort of are fake news. They're pulling punches at some candidates and laying into others. Now, I don't think it justifies Trump, but I mean, that's the basis for it. If you had a credible journalism, Trump couldn't say that and get away with it. But our journalism is such a deep, plummeting crisis, you can't. Now, I've worked really hard over the last 15 years to try to have policies put in place to create the resources for independent, uncensored, competitive journalism. It's been a difficult fight. And I think I've made the case pretty strongly in other venues for why that's so important and why it's appropriate. It's very much in the American political tradition. But one thing I've learned in that is something that's become increasingly obvious is that not everyone wants to have journalism. Everyone likes to mouth off how much they want a free press and a critical press. But it's pretty clear to me that large parts of, important parts of people in this country are very happy having a journalism-free environment. Donald Trump loves it. He couldn't survive a world with journalism. His shtick wouldn't work with any sort of credible journalism. He needs a journalism-free environment where he can just spew his stuff out. He excels at getting attention. He can dismiss any criticism of fake news. This is a situation, fake news of not having credible journalism that breeds cynicism, it breeds apathy, breeds desperation. It spawns all sorts of conspiracy theories. All sorts of bad things happen. It's not an acceptable outcome. So I think what I would argue is that it's imperative that we start taking seriously the idea of building an independent, well-funded, competitive, uncensored press system. And in this struggle, just like the broader political fight of our times, it's not simply in the United States. This is a global struggle. The collapse of journalism is worse in the United States than some European countries, largely because they have public broadcasting still. That's very significant. Some countries like Sweden and Norway, France and Germany also still have very significant newspaper, print media, journalism subsidies, which are brilliant. They subsidize regardless of political viewpoint. They're viewpoint neutral, but they create all sorts of daily newspapers that wouldn't exist without those subsidies. They understand the interest to have competing viewpoints. I was just in England and Scotland for two conferences organized by the National Union of Journalists on fake news, the collapse of local journalism, and what they're going to do. Because journalists in Scotland and England can see that they're in death throes. It's just a matter of time. And they have much stronger journalism cultures in Britain than we do in the United States. and they're trying to be proactive. My own preference is for something that the economist Dean Baker came up with about 15 years ago, and I've been embellishing it since then. And ironically, I'm glad you're all sitting down. The idea was initially cooked up by none other than Milton Friedman in the 1950s. Milton Friedman hates public education. He wants to get rid of it in the 1950s. But he understands that if you just get rid of public education, you go back to the times of Dickens, because 90% of the American people could never afford tuitions for a private school. That would be a tough sell in America. So you acknowledge that it's a public good. You've got to have the government pay for schools. But he said, what we ought to do is give every parent a voucher to pay for schools. Now, I think that's a horrible idea. I don't mind to argue that one. And if it was discredited for 30 years, Milton Friedman suggested it. They have a voucher system to get rid of public schools. And it was dismissed initially because the people who raised it for the white supremacists in the South said, yeah, that's a great idea. Then we can have to send our kids to school with African-American kids. We can just have white-only schools, only private schools with public money. But I do think that Friedman's basic principle is a brilliant one for journalism. We should give everyone over 18 access to $200 a year of government money to give to any nonprofit, non-commercial news medium of their choice, as long as it meets existing, well-established IRS standards for being nonprofit and non-commercial. And then anything that news media produces that get this money instantly goes in the public domain is made accessible to everyone for free online. So you're not creating a corporate welfare here. You're not paying, making people rich on the corporate side. You're basically paying people in advance to do journalism. There's a lot more to it, but I think that is the sort of solution we need. I'm open-minded to other things, but what I do know is we need a huge public subsidy. We need no government control over the content. Those are the two cornerstones of the press that we have to have and strive for, and we don't have that now. We have no money, and because we have no money, we have ironically tremendous government control over what goes into the press with their propaganda and public relations arsenal if they can deploy at any time. Now, when I've talked about politics in general and also about changing media, people sometimes look at me like I've been smoking weed like for months straight. I'm completely deranged. I have no idea how the real world works. But it's hopelessly impossible to think you can change anything in America. And I understand where that's coming from, but I hopefully we're coming out of that stupor, which paralyzes us, because I think we're in the beginning or the midst at some point of a period of extraordinary social change. It's unavoidable. It's all around us. And we should embrace it, and we should definitely see that it's good social change. There's no guarantee the good guys are going to win. If we lay back and just sort of slide it out, bad guys have a much better chance. It's really in our hands to say we can have a role to play. But I think, what we see with Trump, what we see with Sanders, what we're seeing in France, what we're seeing in Britain, the evidence is increasingly clear that the old way is collapsing. Something's coming. I was talking to a friend of mine, one of the smartest political operatives I know, and we were talking about how difficult it is to change the Republican or Democratic parties compared to changing the party system, especially in countries like France or Spain or Italy. And he said, well, wait a second, look how how easy it was for him to take for the Republican Party. He said probably the same thing could happen with the Democrats. And Bloomberg or some billionaire said he wanted to buy it. He could probably go in and buy the nomination. There's not really anything there. There's not really much there. We really can't predict what's gonna happen. And we should operate under the idea that we can influence the future, and it's very much up for grabs. I'd like to close with an anecdote that inspired me, and I hope it will inspire you and inform you. When I was in, some of you might have heard it before, I like to use it a lot. When I was a graduate student in Seattle 30 years ago, finishing my PhD, I was about to leave, it was 1988, and I was about to moved to Madison to start my job there teaching as an assistant professor. And I went in to say goodbye to my professor. He was a white South African who came to the United States in the 1960s. He was from a very liberal family, opposed apartheid. All his family was still in South Africa. His wife was Afrikaans. Her family was all still in South Africa. He was very active working with the AFC and working in the anti-apartheid movement from the United States and followed closely. He knew more about South Africa than anyone I knew. I mean, it was off the charts what he knew. And I went in to see him as I was leaving, and I said, "Hey, Tony, I just want to say goodbye." And he was very glum and despondent. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, "Well, I've just been talking to my friends in South Africa, and they say the situation has never been hopeless there politically. That the government in power refuses to negotiate, to give any credence, open up the system whatsoever for Africa, black people. It's going to remain. Apartheid is entrenched forever. A lot of my friends are talking about escaping the country and just giving up the cause. It looks hopeless." This was in May or June of 1988. Darkest possible moment. This guy had been fighting for 30 years against apartheid. 2 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from Robben Island prison after 30 years of being in prison, 27 years. 4 years after that, he was elected president of South Africa. And in those intervening 6 years, there was less violence than you would see in a New Jersey bar fight. It was done peacefully. You had this extraordinary transition of power. So my friend, who in 1988 had said it was hopeless, was entirely wrong. He missed the moment completely. It was actually right before dawn there that the change would take place. And I think that's oftentimes how it works. You only see it in retrospect. So, yeah, I saw it. I mean, no one ever sees it. It's always a surprise. In fact, I talked to other people who have told the story, other South Africans, say, yeah, we all felt that way. In 1988, we were all ready to throw in the towel. It's horrible how bad it was. 1988, 2 years later, Mandela's out of prison. So I think we're in our 1988 moment, maybe in 1989, so I think we've already seen enough light, but we've seen enough darkness too. And unfortunately, in our case, it's not like we're starting with the worst and it's going to only get better. We're starting where it can still get a lot worse. And so the good guys aren't guaranteed victory. What we do makes all the difference in the world. But one thing we know is if we don't have quality information in the free press, our chances of victory are increasingly remote. Thank you.
That was Robert McChesney speaking at Channing Murray Foundation on Thursday, April 29th. I'm Sandra Auten for CU Progressive News. For listening to CU Progressive News. The views and opinions have been solely those of the speakers. The podcast is sponsored by Phoenix Botanical, providing exceptional service and quality medicine to those that can benefit from medical cannabis. PhoenixBotanical.net. Thank you, as always, to Kevin Elliott for the music, providing the music for CU Progressive News each week, all the interlude music and this outro music that you're listening to right now. You can hear his fingerstyle guitar and all of his singer-songwriter stuff at kevinelliottmusic.com. And also you can catch him on WEFT on Tuesdays from the Joshua Tree Inn from 6 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday, 90.1 FM. Thank you.
This hour of programming is sponsored by the listeners of WEFD and Dancing Dog Eatery and Juicery. Located in downtown Urbana and serving 100% vegan foods and juices, Dancing Dog offers a full menu of smoothies, lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch options. Their menu consists of various items made in-house, including ketchup, plant-based cheeses, granola, and salsa. In a hurry with no time to sit down? No problem. Dancing Dog has a grab-and-go fridge offering quick vegan meals in the heart of Urbana. A full menu is available at Dancing Dog Eatery.